Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, December 18, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Our topic for today's call is the U.S. Senate filibuster rule. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to our call today two experts, both who have been following this issue pretty closely. We're going to hear first from Carrie Severino. She is Chief Counsel and Policy Director at the Judicial Crisis Network. We'll hear opening remarks from her, followed by Mr. Edward Whalen III, who is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. We're going to hear total opening remarks of probably 20 or 25 minutes or so, and then, as always, we'll be turning to you, the audience, for your questions. So please get ready with those questions. And with that, Ms. Severino, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. So in the spirit of the holiday season here, I'm going to be the kind of ghost of filibusters present and talk about what immediately just happened with the filibuster rule, and Ed can do the ghost of filibusters past and give a little more historical context, and then we'll both talk about the future of what this means going forward. So quickly, the immediate history of the filibuster rule in the Obama administration has been one of constant threats and holding this rule hostage, which in what has been functioning as a Democratic way to accomplish their goals while leaving the filibuster intact up until this point. So they had threatened in January 2013 that they were going to change the filibuster rules for starters. They said, we're going to do it at the beginning of the term. Turned out they didn't even quite have the 51 votes they were looking for at that time. But there was a deal that was brokered between Senate Minority Leader McConnell and Majority Leader Harry Reid at that point to make some modest changes to the filibuster rules. Then they brought it up again in July and threatened to change these rules again. At that point, Senator McCain brokered a compromise, which it turns out wasn't really much of a compromise at all, more or less resulted in giving the Democrats almost everything they wanted. And at that point, it was a issue of some executive nominees that were being blocked, as well as some judicial nominees they could see on the horizon being blocked. And they ended up just saying, well, let's confirm all of these nominees, and in exchange, we'll take two National Labor Relations Board members off and replace them with someone else. Those are the members that you'll recall were recess appointed by the president in what turns out not to have been a recess, so an illegitimate use of that power. But removing them and replacing them with other Obama nominees really didn't accomplish anything. In fact, there are strong arguments to be made that the current makeup of the committee is actually worse than it would have been with those two illegitimate appointments. So what we saw there is the Republicans, or at least some subgroup of theirs, saying, let's keep the filibuster, let's not lose this, and then in the process losing everything that they might have wanted the filibuster in order to protect. Then what we saw again was in November. This fall, there had been several other high-profile actual filibusters for a change. Up until then, the filibuster rule had almost never been even used to block judicial nominees, but we saw some judges that were blocked by it, and that's when this decision to use the nuclear option by Senator Reid came up. Now, those filibusters, as significant, were actually of D.C. Circuit nominees. These are the nominees the president put up in June in an effort, a clearly partisan effort, to try to pack that circuit. It's something that Senator Schumer, for example, had promised his donors, we'll fill up the D.C. Circuit one way or the other. Senator Reid said, we've got to get three vacancies, we need at least one more, and then we'll switch the majority. So the goal of these judges to a court that is a very low workload was to switch the majority of the court and push it in a very liberal direction, because the president's interest in using his administrative powers to push his agenda in ways that court would normally be pushing back against, because they're going to be doing the constitutional legal checks on those administrative agency actions. So the Republicans were concerned the D.C. Circuit didn't need new judges, that these judges were put there for avowedly political reasons, and it filibustered the three D.C. Circuit nominees. That brings a total of the filibusters invoked to eight during the eight judicial filibusters, at least during the Obama administration. Ultimately, one of those nominees that was filibustered was confirmed, and a couple of people were filibustered twice. So it was really only five total judges as of November, had even been blocked by a filibuster. What Harry Reid did and what the Democrats were doing was blowing this into a national filibuster crisis. There was a lot of creative accounting going on, and I would view it as a case point for how to lie with statistics. They started counting cloture motions as if they were filibusters and were trying to blow up the numbers to make it look like Republicans were causing a huge logjam. In fact, the handful of nominees that were blocked were three of those D.C. Circuit nominees, which, again, were blocked for political because they were political appointments into a court that didn't need judges. One of them was Caitlin Halligan, who has a very extreme record, and one of them was Goodwin Liu, who has a very extreme record. An additional judge was blocked simply because he was nominated during the end of the term, and there's a general policy the Senate has of not considering nominees during that point. He was later overwhelmingly confirmed. So that was the five judges that accounted for a huge crisis, or so Harry Reid would have had people believe. And then we saw that he, in November, decided to finally move forward with this and change the Senate rules. So now, by a majority vote, a bare majority vote in the Senate, he had, I think, two votes extra, he decided to change the rules. So now there will not be a filibuster available on executive branch nominees or judicial nominees. So that means that these judges in the D.C. Circuit, for example, that have been blocked now are being pushed through. Two of the three have already been confirmed, again, by majorities that were kind of in between that 51 vote and that 60 vote majority. And we anticipate the third of those nominees will be confirmed again, as soon as the Senate gets time to do so, either at the very end of this term or the beginning of next term. I think one thing that's another interesting wrinkle in that is that this counts for executive nominees as well, and there have been rumors that Secretary Sebelius of the HHS will maybe stepping down in the near future, and that would apply to her replacement as well. So it removes some of the leverage that Republicans would have in terms of confirming a new nominee to that post, where they might want to ask for some changes to the now complete debacle of the Obamacare law in exchange for confirming a new HHS commissioner who'd be running those things. Now it'll be much easier for Democrats to move through. But I'll point out that even with a 51-vote majority, that doesn't mean that all of these nominees will necessarily have smooth sailing. In particular on some of the recent D.C. Circuit nominees, we've seen that the Democrats haven't even been able to keep all of their votes together for these nominees. And that's because we are going into an election year, and there are a lot of red state Democrats who are vulnerable and who are going to be concerned that their continued votes for these nominees, it makes them look to their constituents as if they're, you know, oftentimes at home presenting themselves as very moderate candidates, but in D.C. are consistently voting with the president's judicial nominees. My group, Judicial Crisis Network, has actually been making that point in ads targeted at these red state Democrats, because we think that those are if we can target enough of those Democrats and make the point for them that these judges are important, these judges are effectively bringing these liberal policies to bear in D.C. because they're interpreting laws beyond their text, beyond what Congress has done, because they're violating the constitutional limits that the courts are supposed to be keeping them to, then hopefully we can convince those red state Democrats it's in their best interest to actually be as moderate as they claim they are when they're back home and really give a hard look to the president's more extreme nominees, both for judicial positions and hopefully they will as well for executive positions. So I'll turn it over to Ed to talk a little bit about the background, history, and context of the change in the rules then.
Thank you, Carrie. Well, I'd like to offer a longer view of the battle over the filibuster and explain why I'm happy with the abolition of the filibuster in the long run. Yes, it's galling that Senate Democrats can dish it out but can't take it, but I think putting aside the unfair short-term advantage they gain, I think this is overall a welcome development. Let's go back a decade under George W. Bush, when Senate Democrats, having lost their majority in the Senate, launched their unprecedented filibuster campaign against leading Bush nominees, folks like Miguel Estrada to the D.C. Circuit, Priscilla Owen to the Fifth Circuit, Bill Pryor to the 11th Circuit, Janice Rogers Brown, so many others. Now, back then, the Republicans in the Senate had filed cloture petition after cloture petition to try to break the Democratic filibuster. They were unable to do so. Miguel Estrada had a record 7 negative cloture votes. And when 2005 rolled around, the Senate Republicans decided they needed to undertake cloture reform to eliminate the supermajority cloture requirement. They were on the verge of doing that when the so-called Gang of 14 agreement blocked that effort. The Gang of 14 agreement was a sort of modification to the cloture rule whereby 14 senators, 7 on each side, agreed to support cloture on certain specific nominees and also agreed to hold off on filibustering except in undefined extraordinary circumstances. That agreement by its terms applied only during that that Congress, the Congress that ran from 2005 to 2006. And, you know, but we saw as a result of the Republican effort to undertake cloture reform and this Gang of 14 agreement, we saw some judges go through who probably wouldn't have done so otherwise. That includes folks like Bill Pryor, Priscilla Owen, Brett Kavanaugh, and others. Now, of course, the Democrats won control of the Senate in the 2006 elections and were thereafter able to rely on their majority control of the Senate to make the filibuster a much less necessary tactic. But let me turn to why I think the abolition of the filibuster in the long run is a good thing and why I think that the arguments that Republicans were making 10 years ago were the right arguments. Let me emphasize there's been a lot of condemnation of Republicans for supposed hypocrisy in having different views now than they did 10 years ago. Of course, the argument about changed positions is as true with Democrats. I think the difference is one that cuts in favor of Republicans. That is, the campaign of filibusters that Democrats launched 10 years ago dramatically changed the playing field, changed the rules of the game. It would have been unilateral surrender for Republicans not to adapt to those changed circumstances. Senate Democrats, by contrast, again, show that they can dish it out but can't take it. And as soon as the filibuster was used in lesser measure against Obama nominees, talk of the cloture reform, the so-called nuclear option, heated up. And, of course, that's what was done just last month. Well, one reason why I think that abolition of the filibuster in the long run is a good thing is I think that there's an asymmetry in the judicial confirmation process that benefits Democrats when it comes to the filibuster. Part of this ties to the favorable media coverage that the Democrats can count on. Anyone that Democrats are filibustering gets painted as an extremist. When Republicans filibuster someone, you get all this talk about how, oh, they really have no objection to this person, despite all the objections that are being registered. I think that makes it a lot tougher for Republicans to sustain a filibuster than it is for Democrats to do so. Second, I think there's much less difference between a supposedly moderate Democratic nominee who wouldn't trigger a filibuster and the progressive liberal nominee who would than there is between a moderate Republican nominee and a judicial conservative. In other words, I think that Republicans are, if you have a president who's determined to make good picks, he's going to be able to make far better picks without having to worry about the filibuster than a Democratic president is going to be able to, move to his left without worrying about the filibuster. The difference between judicial conservatives and moderates, so-called moderates, is far greater than the difference between so-called Democratic moderates and liberals. I also think that getting rid of the filibuster aligns political accountability in a way that is far more transparent to the public. We now understand that if someone is confirmed, it's because of the Democratic support, the Democratic abolition of the filibuster. This enables us, as Carrie has mentioned, to inflict political costs for bad nominees, just as we did years ago when I was working on Senate Judiciary Committee staff back in the first years of the Clinton administration. We made some Democratic senators very scared of the price they would pay for supporting some of those bad nominees. And back in the 94 elections, judicial nominations played a role in a number of key campaigns. I will say the only real prospect for improvement in the courts requires a good Republican president. There's only so much that can be done on defense. When you have a Democratic president, the filibuster is not that strong a weapon. As I say, I think it's even weaker for Republicans than it is for Democrats. But if and when we next have a good Republican president, we want that president to have as much leeway as possible to make very strong picks. So those are the reasons why, again, in the long run, I think abolition of the filibuster is in the interest of judicial conservatives. Let me highlight one other aspect here, which concerns the Supreme Court. Now, Democrats, in abolishing the filibuster last month, purported that the rule change didn't actually govern Supreme Court nominees. I don't really understand the logic of that, but of course they can say, I suppose the rule is whatever they want it to be. The fact of the matter is that a precedent has been set such that if a Republican nominee to the Supreme Court were facing a serious threat of a filibuster, the option of invoking the rule change by a majority of the Senate, this of course assumes Republican control of the Senate, would be available. I think that is, good precedent to have if that step needs to be taken. More broadly, though, I think the filibuster ultimately is an even weaker tool against the Supreme Court nominees by a president of either party. I think when a Supreme Court nomination is made, the public is going to expect action. I think it's very, very hard to block an up or down vote without incurring political costs. So I don't think there's a huge change in the political dynamics based on what's happened recently. Now, Carrie and I were going to talk a little bit about, I guess, what Carrie calls the ghost of Christmas future. So, Carrie, why don't you start off on that, please?
Sure. I guess I'll talk about the immediate future a little bit. And it's part to underscore some of the things you were saying, Ed. What we saw before is that Republicans were maintaining the filibuster rule, but they were really getting nothing for it. And so while in the short term we're going to see a lot of, real negative results because of the lack of filibuster, we've already seen two of them in the confirmation of Nina Pollard and Patricia Mallette to the D.C. Circuit. Not only are they judges, individuals who I have some objections to on the merits in and of themselves, but also they're being confirmed to a court that doesn't need additional judges at a time when we have, a crisis of trying to pay for our government in the first place, and in a context which makes them very political types of nominees. So that is a definite downside. We could certainly see more of those. But so there is going to be somewhat of a temptation, I fear, on the part of Republicans to say, let's try to push this back. Let's maybe make some kind of deal where we can get the filibuster back. And I think that would be very ill-advised, as as for all the reasons Ed has mentioned, and particularly just from the practical reason, the Democrats, as the way things were going, were going to get these D.C. Circuit nominees confirmed one way or the other, likely. It was simply whether they were going to do so by changing the rules as they did or by getting making another deal with McCain and a handful of others as they had done in the spring. What happens when that those deals are made is that we have exactly the bad result we hoped the filibuster would prevent. We have the judges that are confirmed, and yet the filibuster rule is still in place. One day, hopefully sooner rather than later, the shoe will be on the other foot, and we'll have a Republican president and or Senate involved in these confirmations, ideally both. And at that point, as Ed pointed out, the filibuster rule, having that in place, would be greatly hamper the ability of Republicans to appoint constitutionalist judges who are going to be faithful to the text and the meaning of our laws and the Constitution. So that, while in the short term we're going to definitely lose some seats, I think those were kind of a lost cause anyway. And this ratchet of the filibuster is usually more harmful to originalist judges, to conservative judicial philosophy, than it is helpful in terms of preventing bad nominees from getting onto the court. Certainly, in the recent history, it has been almost entirely ineffective. And I guess there was maybe a couple of those nominees that didn't get on the court that might have been on the D.C. Circuit now. But in fact, they got their three nominees to the D.C. Circuit one way or the other. And so it's simply delayed, didn't change the ultimate result. So in the immediate future, I think what we're going to see is, unfortunately, some bad news. But I think it's bad news we would have had either way. And that with the prospect of having the filibuster out of rule taken away, there's some room for a real silver lining going in the longer term future, which maybe Ed wants to touch on.
Well, sure. Looking forward, we have, of course, have the 2014 elections in which Republicans hope to regain control of the Senate. With the abolition of the filibuster, the minority party in the Senate has has lost significant power as a minority, and control of the Senate means so much more. So it's going to be very important whether Republicans can regain control of the Senate. If they can, obviously, without resorting to the filibuster, they ought to be able to block a lot of bad nominees. I should highlight as well that the individual senatorial prerogative of the blue slip remains available, and indeed is as powerful as ever. This is the, as many of you know, the prerogative of a so-called home state senator to block any nominee he doesn't approve of for a home state seat for any reason whatsoever. And what this means, this is going to hamper President Obama just as it will hamper a Republican president. If you're dealing with a state with two or even one senator from the opposing party, you're going to have to do a lot of deal-making in order to get someone through. So, but the big story in 2014 will be whether Republicans can regain control of the Senate and make basically make filibustering nominees unnecessary in the same way that Senate Democrats, by regaining control of the Senate in the 2006 elections, were able to block whomever they wanted in the subsequent 2 years. When it comes to 2016, again, we'll have the big question here: who gets elected president, who gains control of the Senate, and we'll see how that dynamic plays out. The best case scenario, obviously, from an originalist perspective, is to have a strong Republican president with a Senate in Republican control, and at that point there'd be a green light from the beginning to get strong nominees through in a way that President George W. Bush never really enjoyed. The first 4 years were very, very difficult. The last 2 years were very obstructed, so an awful lot could be accomplished if we get that scenario. Of course, if we end up with a Democratic president and Democratic Senate, then things are going to continue to go to hell in a handbasket. But I think at this point we need to hope that we have have available to us a situation that might help to set things right. So with that, I think we can turn it over to your questions about any of this or any points we should have addressed. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you both. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on.
After that, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. The switchboard is lighting up, as they say. But before we go to our first caller, let me announce that we've just scheduled a conference call for tomorrow at 4 p.m. This was not announced to you earlier in the week because it just got on our schedule. Tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, we'll be discussing the decision earlier this week from the District Court Judge Richard Leon on the NSA data collection matter. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Bob Turner here at UVA. This is an issue that I've been following for a number of years. Indeed, I had an article in a Texas Law Review back, I think, in 06. It seems to me that there's a constitutional issue here that's being missed, and that is the Constitution gives the appointment power to the president in Article 2 and subjects it to a negative or a veto by the Senate. And it seems to me that any time the Senate adds additional impediments, it's departing from the constitutional scheme. In other words, basically the veto is vested in one half of a quorum of the Senate. When the matter comes up, and when you say no, we're going to keep the president from exercising his constitutional power unless he gets unanimous approval by the Senate or some different vote. I have constitutional problems with that. Indeed, as some of you know, Claire McKeskill of Missouri has put a, quote, permanent hold on a very able three-star Air Force general, General Helms, whose nomination has now been withdrawn, declaring in the process that she was placing a permanent hold on the nomination. So that argument is the president cannot nominate without the unanimous approval of the Senate, because any one senator can place a permanent hold. And I find that outrageous. So I don't like seeing bad judges put on by Republicans or Democrats, but I think in something that's involving a particular Article II power, the Senate does not have and should not have the authority to alter the requirement implicit in the Constitution that half the Senate can block, but if there's a majority, the president gets his choice.
Well, if I may, Professor Turner, I respectfully disagree. This is obviously an issue that's been debated in academia, and I don't have the benefit of having your fine article in mind, but I'll just briefly outline how it is that I see this differently. While I have been opposed to the filibuster of judicial nominees, I believe the filibuster to be constitutionally permissible. And I base that judgment on the vesting in each House of Congress of plenary power to make its own rules. I think there are all sorts of obstacles, including committee action, that have been long accepted that can intrude on simple majority action by the Senate. I also don't really agree with the framing of the appointment power as one subject to veto. I think it calls for affirmative consent by the Senate. But again, this is an issue that's been debated in academia, and I don't mean to suggest that my brief account here needs to be taken as authoritative. There's obviously serious commentary on both sides, and I encourage folks to read Professor Turner's Law Review, which I believe he said was from 2006.
And this is Dean Reuter. I also note that Bob Turner has an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal on our subject tomorrow, and that's the NSA data collection issue. With that, we've got some time left, and it looks like five callers with questions, so let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I think you have missed perhaps the most important issue in this question. It really is not about the filibuster. What has happened here is not a change in the Senate rules. What happened is that the president of the Senate violated the rule that it was in place and was sustained in that violation by a simple majority of the members present and voting. That means, as a precedent, that in principle, the majority of those present and voting, not of all members, just of those present and voting, can always override any supermajority rule of the Senate. And we can imagine a future situation where the Senate is equally divided. The vice president is sitting as president of the Senate, and the vice president is simply declaring one bill after another approved over the objection of half the Senate, because the other half of the Senate refuses to overturn his decision. So the import of this precedent is far reaching than anything that has been discussed here for, and deserves much more attention.
I think that point does dovetail with what Ed was talking about in terms of the ability to hold this to a Supreme Court isn't included kind of a limit. In practice, any limits they claim to put on there really are only just nominal and could be overridden by the same 51 vote or, as you point out, 50 vote plus the vice president vote that this
or even those just present on the floor. There could be one other senator on the floor during some of these sessions. That's what's happened. One president, one senator on the floor, and they pass it.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sorry, is this I missed the caller's name?
John Rowland.
I agree, Mr. Rowland, with virtually everything that you've said, with one reservation. But I think that this is a proper understanding of what the plenary power of the Senate means. I think that that to possess that plenary power must include a power vested in the majority to change its rules at any time. There are all sorts of reasons, all sorts of high political costs that would be imposed for abuse of this. And I would say the one respect in which I disagree with you is I understand this precedent to have been established through various means long ago. So I don't think this is the first time. This makes it quite clear that it's the Senate's view of its power. But again, I think that inheres in the nature of a legislative body's ability to make its own rules that must ultimately be. I think they must ultimately lie with the majority. I don't see how a majority can tie its hands in any effective way. And I think what you count on here is that the rules themselves, once they're promulgated, have some sort of binding effect that imposes political costs on their being changed.
Their own rules are that rules changes require a two-thirds majority.
So that's gone
out the door.
It has effectively gone out the door. I agree with what you say on that. And my only point would be, I think it had already been recognized to have really been out the door before, and it's simply a matter of when they're going to override that.
Yeah, and the fact that three Democrats voted against the rules change illustrates that there is a political cost that is still going on. So I think the more extreme hypothetical you come up with, the harder it actually would be to maintain party discipline for Democrats who wanted to do some of the more extreme kind of shenanigans that you're proposing. So hopefully that will be enough to keep them in check.
Or of course the risk might also be an opportunity in some circumstances, depending on the configuration of the Senate.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got four questions pending, and I think we'll get to everybody. So let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Mike Stern in Washington. My question is actually pretty much the same as the previous caller, so I won't go into it too much. I guess just following up on the responses. I guess you're saying that the Senate can, under the rules of proceeding clause, the Senate can adopt a rule that says one thing and then interpret it to mean some, as long as the majority decides it means something completely different, that's essentially within its power. And I would just ask, do you think there's a rule of law cost there? Just whatever the rules of proceedings mean, it must mean something that they're supposed to adopt some sort of standard in some sort of procedurally regular way, as opposed to saying we can decide our rules mean whatever we want at any particular moment.
Well, thanks, Mike. And again, in fairness, I'll just point out that what the Democrats did procedurally was, as I understand it, exactly what the Senate Republicans aimed to do procedurally back in 2005. There was at the beginning of this year the notion that Harry Reid floated that the rules had to be made at the outset, and it was thought that once you got past that, it'd be impossible, or at least politically more costly to change them. They've obviously shown that they can get past that barrier. But now, obviously, if the objection is valid, it applies both to what Republicans proposed in 2005 and what happened now. In my looking at the merits of it and talking with former Senate parliamentarian, I'm not persuaded of the merits of the objection, but others might well be.
And I think it's also, I have to agree, though, to a certain extent, having rules that we then interpret to mean something that is plainly not what they say does kind of undermine the culture of rule following. I think it might be better to just have a rule that says you can change everything by majority vote. But I think Ed certainly I think describes correctly the reality of what the procedure tends to have been. It might be nicer to have it explicit, but that's how it's been interpreted.
Well, if I could just say, I mean, there is one difference. I mean, I agree that one can interpret what a majority did this time to be the same as what the Republicans intended to do in 2005, with one exception that Ed mentioned, which is this carve-out for the Supreme Court. Because as I understand the theory in 2005 was that the filibuster was unconstitutional as applied to nominations generally. But I don't know of any theory that would say it's unconstitutional as to all nominations except for the Supreme Court. And so trying to come up with Yeah,
I'm sorry. I don't think that the theory, insofar as it was articulated in 2005, rested on a notion that the filibuster was unconstitutional. I think it instead was just the assertion of power. The rule wasn't intended to and shouldn't apply to judicial nominees generally. The carve out, I think we're in agreement that the carve out is conceptually incoherent. But I suppose once we get out of the rule of law realm, where rules mean something and should be followed, we're in this world where people can just make things up and draw lines. It's not satisfactory. I agree with you. It's not the best of all situations.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Tom McElmillan, Seattle. I have a question about the blue slip, but first, my understanding is that in this particular instance, the parliamentarian in the Senate actually ruled that the majority was out of order and could not change the rules by a majority, but the majority of the Senate said no. You're out of order, Mr. Parliamentarian, or something to that effect. Is that the case? Is that what happened here?
That's what I understand. That the parliamentarian applies the accepted understanding of the rule, and the Senate majority effectively modifies the rule by overruling the parliamentarian's objection. This gets into very obscure stuff. I think I have this right, but my apologies if I'm off on this.
Which would be fine if you don't want the parliamentarian to be running the Senate, but
right.
I mean, you want the majority, I mean, at least to have the majority run the Senate. But anyhow, getting to my question about the blue slip, is it true, the earlier caller suggested that Senator McCaskill, as an example, had put a permanent hold on a nomination. Doesn't the Senate have the power to pull up a nomination despite a blue slip being entered or whatever that goes? How does that work?
Well, Carrie, if I may, I guess I first distinguish blue slips from holds. The blue slip is a home state senator prerogative, which in theory, yes, could be overridden. But I tell you, if there's one thing that about 100 senators really care about, it's protecting the prerogative of a home state senator to block a nominee he really dislikes. Indeed, there was a remarkable episode a couple years ago when one nominee had actually already received blue slips from both of his home state senators. This is Steve Six, who was a nominee to the 10th Circuit out of Kansas. And when objections were raised in connection with his hearing to certain things, the home state senators, one or both of them, I think, said that they now oppose him, even though they had turned in their favorable blue slips. And Senator Leahy is so protective of the blue slip prerogative that he said if they're going to stand by their opposition, that nominee will not move, and he was ultimately withdrawn. So yes, there surely is theoretical Senate power to override a blue slip, but the as a practical matter, senators care very deeply about their own individual power in their states, and the blue slip is very sacred. On holds, I confess I'm not sure that I fully understand what the rules governing holds are now. I thought there had been a reform a couple of years ago that limited holds, or maybe it simply made them more transparent. But again, that yes, that is something that could be overridden by a majority, and certainly ultimately. And I'm not sure just what the rules govern this at all, but it could be overridden. Carrie,
you've been. That seems right. Yeah. Certainly, if you can change the other rules by 51 vote, you ought to be able to do it to the holds. Again, it's just a matter of the political costs. The public political costs to your constituents, and then the personal costs of loss of the power yourself that I think would come into play to maybe, at least in this case, it seems like they're not willing to change it. But you can imagine a case where it was high profile enough that they would be willing to step up and say we're not going to allow it. If it were maybe, for example, a Supreme Court nominee where the political costs are going to be much higher, it might start to look egregious, and then someone would probably have to step up and do something. So.
And the blue slips, the blue slip so-called rule is not stated in Senate rules. I don't even think it's stated in committee rules. And I think that same, I think it may also be the case that the hold isn't acknowledged in the Senate rules, which may illustrate this topsy-turvy world in which unstated rules have more force than express rules.
Thank you.
Let's take another question.
Hi, thank you. Matthew Christ out of Virginia. And my major questions have mostly been answered, but I had one follow-up minor question, and also kind of for illustrative purposes. We can all recall out of the Roberts rules, there is a rule for abandoning the rules. So we are kind of in a topsy-turvy world. But my minor question is, really, is there a lowercase c constitutional issue here where the bare majority can just take over and do whatever it pleases? Is there another, like I said, a lowercase c constitutional issue?
I suppose the Senate not having a constitution per se, it's not, it's hard to make it much more than it does seem, one could say this is anarchy because they're not following the rules that they set down, but it still is anarchy by 51 votes. You still have to get a majority to do it.
Yeah.
It's not. It just really is imposing a more direct majoritarian understanding of what the Senate is. And while that's not the system we have for our federal government, is governed by the Big C Constitution, it's also not something that's entirely foreign to the concept of running a democratic system. So I think it's not the end of the world if it does.
Well, I think if we understand this lower C constitution to be customs and practices that over time have governed the body, I think the biggest departure from that constitution was the Democrats' filibuster campaign against Bush nominees in beginning in 2003. And what we may have here is a, you know, restoration to the situation ex ante. Again, I'm not, you know, I think it's rather sleazy how it was done only after accruing the benefit of the change. I'm, you know, it's less clear to me that the abolition of the filibuster itself, or at least the state, or at least the situation which the filibuster is no longer to be resorted to, is a violation of this unwritten constitution.
Okay, thank you.
Let's hear from another caller. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, we've got four questions pending now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, a series of questions here. Mike S., the parliamentarian procedure that was discussed, where the parliamentarian said that it was against the rules, and then a majority of senators overruled the parliamentarian. Wasn't that by rule? Wasn't there a rule in place that allowed the majority of senators to do that? So, in fact, wasn't everything according to established rules? Another question I have is why you think Leahy is so much more deferential to the blue slip procedure than Senator Orrin Hatch was. And the last question I have is, don't conservatives bear some responsibility here? I mean, there are plenty of conservatives that were in the Senate and part of the Gang of 14 back when Bush was in the office and, you know, pledged to only filibuster under extraordinary circumstances. There were a series of handshake agreements between McConnell and Reid that were ultimately disrespected. And if we're going to talk about sleazy deviation from established procedures in the Senate, isn't keeping your word one of the most established procedures in the Senate that, you know, whether we like it or not, conservatives didn't adhere to?
Thanks. If you stay on so we can make sure we get keep all three of your questions in mind. Carrie, can I start with the third one?
Yeah, I was just going to defer that to you because I think that and Hatch, you tend to be
excellent. Yeah, I don't know what these handshake agreements that you refer to are or what their terms supposedly are. You've referred to the Gang of 14 agreement as though it extended beyond the 14 senators who are party to it, and as though it extended beyond the very limited term by which they expressly operated. So, it's one thing to assert handshake agreements that have supposedly been violated. I simply don't know. I guess I'd be interested in what your evidence is for such agreements and what their terms are, because I have no idea what you're referring to.
And I'll point out, actually, I know Senator Landrieu, I think, offhand, and I think there are other Democrats who signed those agreements who have also viewed them as time-limited, as Ed mentioned, and have later voted to filibuster nominees. So I don't think anyone, even party to the agreements, necessarily viewed them as for all times and all places kind of thing.
Just to answer your questions, there were a series of media reports that I don't have in front of me right now about the handshake agreements between McConnell and Reid. I believe there were at least two of them, two separate negotiations where, you know, use of the filibuster, the parties agreed that it would be limited. And as it turns out, it wasn't, at least in terms of nominees. The Gang of 14, I'm not asserting that it extended beyond the 14
okay.
that were a party
okay.
to it. What I'm saying is that of the 14, there were enough Republicans to join with Democrats remaining in the Senate that if they had respected what they promised back then, and I'm not saying that it's a good answer that it was time-limited, but if it wasn't, there were enough remaining to overcome any filibusters.
Okay, so again, I have never heard Reid refer to the content of any supposed agreements that McConnell has violated. So I'll, you know, send me something if you run across something on that, I'd be interested. In terms of Leahy versus Hatch on the blue slip, you are right to refer to an episode involving Carolyn Kuhl, a Ninth Circuit nominee from California, where Hatch proceeded to give her a hearing in the face of objection from home state senators. That was, you know, it's a lot of heat for that, you know, and, you know, I think that Leahy and others objected. In terms of exactly, you know, why Leahy appears to give more weight to the blue slip than Hatch did, at least in that instance, I don't know. I think, again, as I mentioned, the blue slip is a valuable senatorial prerogative for narrow self-interest. I've written an essay about how these senatorial prerogatives disserve the interest of good nominations. But that said, you know, I think you're, you know, I don't dispute at all your observation that, and indeed I made the point that Leahy is very protective of the blue slip. Your first point, I'm sorry, I don't have any notes. Your first question, I don't have in my notes right now. So if you could just briefly refresh me as to what that is.
Sir, we.
I do remember. Yeah, you're saying that they were following the procedural rules and changing the rules. I understand that to be true. Yes. You know, again, it still raises the rule of law point that for, you know, a majority to say X means not X presents rule of law concerns. But, you know, having defended that, I'm not going to, you know, argue vigorously against myself here. But I do think there are those who have raised rule of law concerns about it have a good point that isn't overridden by the fact that certain procedures were followed. Carrie?
I think I agree. My understanding is that they followed that particular procedure was within the rules itself. While raising some of the issues of reading the rules in a way that doesn't seem entirely consistent with the text, but, you know, that's, again, that's their kind of majoritarian prerogative to a certain extent.
Well, as if by magic, we still have four questions pending. We've got about 8 minutes left, so I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible in framing their questions and realize there are other people on the line with questions. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, this is Dave Tryon in Cleveland. Quick question about the political fallout on this. As I recall, when all this was happening, I seem to remember the minority leader saying there would be retribution or there would be consequences for Harry Reid doing this, and it was sort of suggested that it would be even before the Republicans regained control of the Senate. And I thought, I wonder what they could possibly do, and as far as I know, they've done nothing. Is there something, in fact, that they can do for retribution, and has anything been done?
Well, I think certainly the Republicans can not roll over and make it easy for the Democrats to then go ahead and confirm these nominees. So while they know they're not going to ultimately be able to block them by blocking cloture, they can at least require that they use all the 30 hours of debate on all the nominees, which then eats up time. I think that's what they did with the D.C. Circuit nominees. Again, it can't block the nomination overall, but it does make it a little bit more costly. There are people suggested that there might be retribution in terms of less willingness to turn in blue slips. I'm not familiar enough with the facts on the ground to know if that has happened or if there's anyone who's actually planning on doing it. But that's another angle that Republicans could theoretically do if they wanted to exact more costs out of Democrats in the short term.
Well, the Senate operates heavily on the principle of unanimous consent, and unanimous consent is routinely given to all sorts of measures that would otherwise require cumbersome votes. So I think understanding from the threat you mentioned that there might be more denial of unanimous consent and forcing the Democrats to go through these more tortuous procedures. Some of that may have happened with respect to some votes. You know, the Senate was in session overnight last week and for much of the weekend. I will say that one advantage of that the minority has is When it comes to denying unanimous consent, you really need to have only one person present. Now, you had lots of senators present for these overnight sessions, but I believe the minority can really put the disproportionate burden on the majority to have, you know, it's 50 plus senators present. Why you just have, you know, one or two or three minority senators present to shuffle in and out to object to a request for unanimous consent. So we'll see if more of that is done. Now, I guess in theory that could all be, you know, those rules could also be changed. But I do think there's a well entrenched norm in the Senate that gives a lot of weight to this principle of unanimous consent.
Thanks.
Let's go to our next caller.
This is Ramon Bueller with the Madison Coalition in Virginia. My question is there some way, is there a rule, leave aside the question of whether it could get two-thirds, that the Senate could pass that would restore essentially rule of law, at least with respect to the 60-vote threshold for considering legislation? One idea which I don't think would work politically would be to make that particular rule subject to court review if somebody wanted to reinterpret it. But have you thought at all about a way to put this genie back in the bottle with a, let's call it a rule of law rule in the Senate?
I don't see how it's possible. I mean, again, I think the meta principle is that a majority of senators, or as I think one caller pointed out, a majority of senators present on the floor at any one time has the ultimate power to make the rules, and I don't see how you can have this sort of entrenchment. Now, of course, the filibuster rule for legislation, remains in theory unaffected. Though, again, as another caller has pointed out, the step taken here could equally apply. Could be used to override the filibuster of legislation, but I don't see how it's possible, short of a constitutional amendment, to entrench a supermajority cloture rule for legislation.
Yeah, I agree, and the burden for passing a constitutional amendment is probably well beyond what we could actually accomplish. But I'll reiterate again, I'm not entirely sure we want to put the genie back in the bottle, at least with respect to judicial nominees, because I think there's a lot to be gained for solid constitutionalist and originalist judges from this rule. The challenge is simply that we also have to wait for the political process to move in favor of someone who would be appointing or confirming those nominees as well.
Just one other quick point, if I may. I think that senators have a political interest in having the supermajority cloture rule for legislation. Senators don't like to do things that are controversial. They like to have the protection of being able to say that what they did was bipartisan. So again, I think in their own self-interest is to retain this rule. Now, obviously, Obamacare was one major exception to that in the way it was ultimately enacted. Extraordinary situations and pressure may, lead to deviations. But as a general rule, I think that senators of both parties like having the protection, the political insulation that the supermajority rule on legislation provides.
What about a rule that just said this rule, with regard to the 60-vote threshold, shall not be subject to reinterpretation by the parliamentarian or by a majority of the Senate? Basically, making it very clear, all legislation shall require 60 votes.
Instead you take the first step of just of negating that rule and then go on and do it. I don't see how it's possible. I don't see how it can be done.
I raise the political cost slightly, but ultimately they can get around it, just as Ed mentioned.
I should have asked at the outset whether our speakers can hang on for a couple extra minutes. Can we take a couple more questions, or do you both have to stop now?
I can hang on.
Carrie?
Yep, I'm available, yeah.
Okay, let's go one more question here.
Yes, David Emerson, a society member in Berkeley. With the change of the filibuster rule to a simple majority with respect to this class of judicial nominees, apart from, you know, the obvious consequence of there just being more nominees approved, and is there a larger consideration that the types of nominees are going to be largely more ideological, less centrist, the logic being that with the filibuster, there would need to be an appeal across the parties in order to get the nominees approved? And if that's the case, could this actually fundamentally change the nature of the judiciary over a period of years to be a much more partisan itself group?
Well, it's a good observation. I'm sorry, Carrie, go ahead.
No, go on. Go on, Ed.
Okay, well, it's a good observation. I guess I'd point out two things, though. First, prior to 2003, it was widely understood that there would not be filibusters of judicial nominees. So I think you had the same situation for the history of the Republic, you know, up till then that you have now. Does that make it make it more possible to have so-called extreme nominees? Yes, it does. But there are plenty of reasons why presidents don't want to go that way, and senators don't want to go that way. Among other things, they have to worry about the political cost for bad nominees. You know, I think your observation is correct that this makes it easier to move to the extremes. But I would say that there are plenty of other political factors that will operate to prevent that, just as they operated before 2003 to prevent that.
And if I can just point out, you know, we look at Mark Pryor, who prior to the ads that my group organization ran highlighting his judicial votes, he had voted for every single one of the president's nominees, including some of the really extreme ones who ended up getting blocked, like Caitlin Halligan and Goodwin Liu, and cast his first ever vote against them shortly after we ran ads highlighting that fact in his home state in the year before he's got to stand for re-election. So I think there is a window here to use this opportunity to make the judicial issue more salient and to make those Democratic senators in moderate purple or red states to have to really consider what they want to do. And they certainly can help put pressure within their own party on maybe keeping back at least some of the most extreme nominees, particularly going into an election year. And then we're going to be going into a presidential election year, obviously, after that. So I think the recent news shows that the administration was pushing back regulations that they knew were going to be politically costly right before an election year. I think that hopefully going into election we'll see the same effect with pushing back maybe some of the really extreme judicial nominees as well, simply to hold that somewhat in check even though we don't have the filibuster in place. And then just finally, practically speaking, we weren't getting much mileage out of the filibuster anyway, so how much they'll feel that their hands are freed not having to worry about it, I don't know. I'm not sure if they really were taking it that seriously in the first place. I guess we'll have to watch what the president does to find out.
Let's quickly take a final question here.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy with the Committee for Justice. First, I just want to thank Carrie and Ed for an excellent analysis of the state of nominations in the wake of Reid's use of the nuclear option. My question was going to be about retribution, and that was already asked, so I guess I'll just take this opportunity to add that if Republicans chose to play hardball and force 30 hours of debate on every nomination, that would, I mean, there's not enough floor time for that, so that would severely tie up the Senate. A lot less nominations would be confirmed than were confirmed before Reid invoked the nuke option. So there is that option. Do I really think the Republicans are going to do that? No. Also, I wanted to clarify something about holds, because I think its power tends to get exaggerated. A hold is just a standing objection to unanimous consent for proceeding to the nomination, and that can be overcome with a vote. It does burn up floor time for debate, and like a blue slip, senators are inclined to respect holds to preserve the prerogative for itself, but I just wanted to somewhat demystify it, and if Carrie or Ed disagree with my points or want to elaborate, I'd like to hear their thoughts.
Sounds right to me, Kurt.
Carrie, a final thought there?
That Kurt's point makes sense to me. So sounds correct.
Well, terrific. Let me, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank both Carrie Severino and Ed Whalen. This has been a very, very interesting discussion, so thank you both for making time for it. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 4 p.m., when, again, we'll be discussing the NSA data collection matter, and in particular, the decision from earlier in the week from District Court Judge Richard Leon. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.